This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, July 22nd. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. The official opening ceremony for the 2020 Summer Olympics in Tokyo is scheduled for Friday. The games were delayed for a year by the pandemic, and in June, as coronavirus cases began to spike again around the world, Japan declared a state of emergency, banning all spectators at Olympic events. Several athletes, including Coco Gauff, the American tennis star, were diagnosed with COVID-19 before traveling to Japan, and more than 70 people connected to the games have tested positive for COVID. Some advertisers have withdrawn their support, and many fear the Olympics could become a super spreader event. At a press conference last week, Thomas Bach, the president of the International Olympic Committee and a former gold medalist in fencing, addressed criticism about the decision to go forward with the games.
My appeal to the Japanese people to welcome these athletes here for their competition of their life, and to acknowledge that it is not for any price that these athletes are coming here. They have the same interest like the Japanese people that these games are safe and secure, and for this they accept and even welcome restrictive measures which make these Olympic Games the most restricted sports event, not only in Japan, as you know, but in the entire world.
Louisa Thomas writes about sports for The New Yorker. This week, she sat down with Angela Ruggiero, who has a unique perspective on the Games. After competing in four Olympic competitions as a member of the U.S. women's hockey team, Ruggiero became a member of the International Olympic Committee. She also has been a member of the board of the United States Olympic Committee and helped to organize Los Angeles' successful bid to host the 2028 Summer Olympics. In this conversation, she discusses the challenges the organizers and the athletes face in Tokyo and what these games could mean for the future of the Olympics. Here's Louisa Thomas.
Hi, Angela.
Hi.
So, we are speaking on Tuesday, and as of now, the Olympics are set to begin on Friday in Tokyo. It will be an Olympics unlike any other. Obviously, there is a lot of anxiety, especially in Japan, but also around the world. It's quite well documented that there are people who think this Games shouldn't be held during a pandemic, especially in a place that is under a state of emergency. And I guess the first and inescapable question is, should the Games be going on?
I mean, the Olympics are one of the most special moments in time for any athlete. If you're able to compete and at the world's highest stage, there's nothing like it. So just on behalf of the athletes, I do think they should go on. I think that it's their moment in so many ways. And, you know, I actually missed a world championship in 2003, got canceled because of the SARS virus. And that was devastating. I trained a whole year, you know, made the team, and we, you know, the Worlds got canceled. And these athletes, again, have trained their whole lives, or at least have been training for the last 5 years since Rio. And, you know, I guess I'm deferring in some ways to the Japanese government, the organizing committee, the IOC. A lot of sports organizations over the last year and a half have hosted games pretty much in a bubble, which is the scenario we're facing with the Olympics in Tokyo. This isn't in some ways a new thing. It's just the volume and the size is the thing that I'm sure they're leveraging best practices. They've been in close contact with the major professional leagues. And, you know, besides the point that I was making before with athletes, is a moment of inspiration that I think the world desperately needs right now, that, you know, that we can, you know, for those 3 weeks, tune in and escape in some ways, or be inspired, or feel a sense of national pride. I mean, there's so many wonderful things about the Olympics, which is why I believe, you know, it's gonna happen, and everyone's trying to figure out the best way to do it safely.
If you could put yourself back, you know, in one of your Olympic opening ceremonies, can you imagine what it might be like for some of these athletes walking into that empty stadium? I mean, how would you be feeling? Would you feel yourself any sense of conflict or relief?
Well, there's absolutely nothing like walking into the opening ceremonies when the stadium is packed and you know the world is watching. And we love that. I mean, that is the most watched part of the games when it's, you know, I always describe you're walking through the tunnel and it just erupts and you have all these people cheering for you. So I think everything is relative. I think a lot of these athletes understand that it's not going to be the same. And yes, I'm sure it's disappointing that they don't get that moment where they walk into the venue and it's packed, but they certainly know their friends, their family, the world is still watching them. And even though those opening ceremonies will be very different than my experience, but I think everyone's expectations have been changed quite a bit. And, you know, they've been training, you know, in unfathomable conditions in their backyards with, you know, I'm a hockey player. I'm sure, you know, a lot of athletes don't have access to the normal facilities. And so to be able to come out here and display what they're doing, it'll look and feel very different. But I think it's the fact that they get to be there is at the end of the day what they want.
Have you been talking to any athletes who feel any sense of conflict? Or is it sort of uniformly like this is what we've been waiting for and we've been waiting in for an extra year?
I think the majority of athletes are just so grateful they get to be there, that it's happening. You know, it was already delayed a year. But there are athletes that I think are aware of there's risk. In some ways, they are trusting the organizing committee. They're trusting the IOC. They're trusting the safety protocols that are being put in place so that if something bad happens, you know, if there's an outbreak, one, that they're all the safety precautions have been made so they don't suffer personally, but also that the Japanese population doesn't. I mean, I think they're trusting that the proper procedures are in place or else they would have canceled the games outright. So I mean, it's not going to be fun. There's no, when I was competing, I got to, you know, whether it was Nagano or Torino or Vancouver or Salt Lake, I got to hang out in the city and meet with my friends and go try sushi, go try, you know, the local cuisine, enjoy the city. And these athletes recognize it's the venue and back to the village and very little socialization, the typical Olympic experience. But they understand that's their responsibility to keep the game safe, you know, with 10,500 roughly athletes and then, you know, the Paralympics coming afterwards. I think everyone recognizes the intensity of the moment and wants to do everything possible to make sure it's a great experience for everyone.
I mean, you mentioned that there is a sort of prototype in place, the NBA bubble, the WNBA bubble. These bubbles have been largely successful in containing, keeping out cases and but this scale is different. The NBA has a few hundred players. This is thousands of athletes, you know, and there is more because of the volunteers. There's more intermixing with the population. And already, you know, we've seen cases. I mean, I think it's creeping up toward 100 of accredited people who have tested positive. And I suspect, you know, since it's already begun and since some of them are already in the village, we're just going to have this steady drip of COVID positive results in the news. And so the athletes are not going to be able to escape it, and the public is not going to be able to escape it. And I'm wondering, A, do you think that would that affect performance of some athletes? Like, is that going to be, or are they kind of at this point able to put it out of their minds? Are they that good at focusing, most of them? And then I guess my other question is, you know, you've said that they put their trust in the IOC and, you know, that you believe that everybody has to put their trust in the organizers. They wouldn't be having it otherwise. But already we've seen the bubble sort of break down at certain points. Is it valid to put the trust there? Or is this sort of a situation, as some are saying, where the games are sort of too big to fail and, you know, we're going to be assessing the collateral damage afterwards?
For an athlete, at that level, the focus of competing in spite of all the obstacles is what defines those elite athletes. But you layer this, as I mentioned before, it's another layer that's unlike any other layer I've ever seen. It is this public health responsibility for the athletes to do exactly what they're told. And the good thing is most athletes do, because we're athletes and we're used to getting told what to do by our coach, and strict repercussions if we don't. Again, the mindset of the athletes and the strictness that they're going to have to adhere, and all the supporting staff will be unlike anything you've ever had. You know, if we can control something, the IOC, if the organizing committee, if the Japanese government can control something, it's going to be controlled in terms of, you know, the athletes following protocols. So, you know, everyone, I think, is doing what they can to make sure that they limit exposure for everyone.
You have, I'm talking to you on Zoom and I can see you have some torches on the back of the wall. Are those Olympic, Olympic torches? What are those?
Those are.
Those are Olympic torches. So you are obviously, you know, deeply embedded in the Olympic movement. And I was wondering, you know, I feel like so much of the coverage, understandably, is, I can't believe they're doing this. This is a potential disaster. I mean, it's the New York Times front page had a headline the other day, you know, should the games be gone? And I was wondering if, let's say they did cancel the games, obviously it'd be ruinously expensive. We all know, you know, how many billions of dollars are at stake, but we also know that lives are at stake. So what would be lost, in your opinion, if these games did not go on?
Well, I'll just tell you, my prior experience with the Olympics, and especially the 8 years I served on the IOC, I saw firsthand how it's bringing the world together as opposed to dividing us. I mean, I was in Pyeongchang when I was in the locker room talking to the North and South Korean women's ice hockey team. That was unbelievable to me, that two warring countries could come together in Pyeongchang, compete under the same jersey. Maybe sport is brokering dialogue, maybe it's starting discussion. And there are so many countless stories that I have. I remember in 06, Iran had just announced their nuclear program, and we had this little marching ceremony in the village when the flag gets raised. And coincidentally, it was the US, Iran, and one other country that were arriving at the same time, and we had to walk with them. And, what do we do? What do we do? And the athletes are going, we walk. Obviously, that's the whole point of this. And so there's so many stories, I think, from the athletes, from the fans, from the world, that it would be devastating to have them canceled, especially last minute with these athletes. And, you know, they're not going to reorganize them. They would just cancel this edition of the games. There's no question about that. I think everyone's trying to do what they can to keep those games on.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
You've been on, you know, the other side of this. You've been part of the team that put it together a bid for the LA Olympics. You've, you know, obviously worked with the IOC. Do you think that the Olympic, you know, one critique of it is that it's this celebration of sport, but also of global excess. And do you think there are things that, you know, we can take away or organizers can take away to figuring out how to create a more sustainable games that is more, you know, responsive to local populations and local concerns? And are those conversations happening about what lessons can be taken away, not just for a global pandemic, but for the games in the future?
Yeah, all the time. And I've seen a massive, I think, transformation internally at the IOC from treating the games more like a franchise where, you know, you lift and shift the same model and have very strict blueprint to saying, let the games work for your city. How does every city that wants to host the Olympics make it theirs and use it to the benefit of their population? Most of the time, and this is the case in LA, where it's Mayor Garcetti saying, I want to redo our airports. I want to make public transport easier. I want to try to make LA more green. So I think moving forward, it's less about, to your point, of excess and more about how do you take this amazing sporting event that can leave a legacy that could be physical, but doesn't necessarily have to be. It could be human. What's the funding that's going to go into youth sports? What's the funding that's going to help get more kids to be active and get that population moving? What are the other things that we can do outside of just using the games to put on a massive sporting event? I will say there just is a appetite now, and the IOC is leaning into Paris 24, leaning into LA 28, saying, how do you evolve the current model, make it better, make it more sustainable, help leave that human legacy? Because so much, I think, of previous games have been focused on the physical infrastructure and the physical investment, why you see those big numbers. And I don't think enough attention has been paid to what is that human legacy that you're going to leave?
You're describing the Olympic ideal as, you know, building communities and connecting people, as you say, as opposed to dividing people. But there are also always stories coming out of the Olympics about how the Olympics require, you know, certain populations to be displaced. And, you know, it can be a difficult time for a lot of people, and there are movements that are built against that and increasing activism against the Olympics. And I just was wondering how, as you say, the IOC's blueprint for hosting cities, whether or not people are really taking a second look at that, or whether or not that's a sort of rhetorical move.
No, it's fair. It's fair. Questioning or criticism, I really believe in the time I was on the IOC, it shifted dramatically. And part of it was what you're saying. Populations were speaking up. Athletes were speaking up saying, I don't want you to displace people. I don't want this to be an unsustainable event. I want this to reflect my values. I mean, there's a lot of, I think, increasing pressure coming from the athletes specifically as well. So it's really what I've seen is a more of a partnership conversation with the city. So I was the chief strategy officer of the LA bid. Once the LA won the games and handed that off to the organizing committee in LA, it's LA talking with the IOC for over 10 years and trying to, again, build what will that games look like. But Louisa, have seen this movement under the leadership of Christoph Dubé saying, hey, let's work with in partnership. Not, hey, here's a list of things you must do because it's how we've always done things. Let's work within the confines of again, what's helpful for that city. So a lot of the Olympic partners, too, think about Intel and Coca-Cola and Visa and some of these big brands that are spending hundreds of millions of dollars. They want the Olympics to reflect who they are. I'm saying this, I'm the CEO of Sports Innovation Lab. We're a global market research company. We cover sports and technology and how fans are changing. And across the board, you know, we call them fluid fans. These future fans vote with their values. They vote with, you know, they will spend when they can find a league, a team, a property like the Olympics that aligns to who they are. So I think increasingly consumers are standing up saying, I demand more from every brand, including the sports brands that are previously just entertaining me. Those properties, those sports properties see that and are the good ones are listening and evolving. And I really think that, again, the IOC recognizes that we have to do more. So there's a movement. They're aware.
Yeah. I mean, there's some sort of tragic tension here because you are describing, you know, the values of the Olympics. And yet we know that the local population, perhaps the world population, is maybe saying that this game shouldn't go on. And this is happening. And maybe once it begins, everybody will embrace it. And obviously I will be watching, you know, I will be cheering. You know, I'm not saying this as someone who is going to vote with my TV remote by not watching or anything. I'm saying, but do you think there is some responsibility within the IOC or among athletes to acknowledge that there's just a tremendous amount of anxiety about what this might mean for the community that they're in, they find themselves in.
I can only imagine. Yeah. I mean, look, if there's a spike, I believe everyone's open to it. If I were competing right now and I would be scared that I would, you know, even though I'm vaccinated, that, you know, I would be contributing to it and that'd be a heavy burden to hold. So I'm sure every athlete has their own unique way of thinking about this, of dealing with it. I can't speak for all athletes, other than that they need to do what they can to protect each other and the people of Japan and so that the games can go on. But as of right now, you know, we're all looking forward to Friday.
What are you looking forward to most? Who do you want to watch?
Well, this is my first Olympics because I was a member. So I got to actually help and be part of the work. You know, I got to give medals and I was, you know, on the boots on the ground. But this is my first Olympics watching since Beijing in 2008. And I'm just so excited to see and hear the stories because I got to see the sport. I just want to hear who these people are and what they've been, how they've been living, how they've been training. And you know, I've been working from home and I had a baby last year and I'm trying to, you know, survive in a various way. And so I'm honestly looking forward to hearing about these athletes and their stories and being inspired for a few weeks.
I think we can probably leave it on being inspired. Thanks for being with us, Angela.
Thank you so much for having me, Louisa.
Angela Ruggiero is the CEO and co-founder of Sports Innovation Lab and a member of the Olympic Hall of Fame and the Hockey Hall of Fame. Louisa Thomas is a staff writer at The New Yorker, the author of three books, and a co-editor of Losers, Dispatches from the Other Side of the Scoreboard. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.